Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Well, EJ, they did it. They fired Mike Vrabel. Even though pretty much every single NFL fan on earth could tell you that was probably a bad move, the Titans said, nah, we'll take our chances on the open market. We'll get rid of a guy who took us to the playoffs several years in a row, got a coach of the year nod, went to an AFC championship. Yeah, let's kick him to the curb. That's probably a good idea. I hate the move. You hate the move. Taylor Lewan hates the move. Every Titans player that's commented on it hates the move. Amy Adams Strunk does not. She deemed it to be the appropriate time to move on from Mike Vrabel. We'll see how that goes for him over the next 5 to 10 years or so. But in the meantime, we're going to be talking about not just the Titans opening and who we think could possibly follow an act as good as Vrabel down there in Nashville, as well as all the other confirmed coaching openings, a couple coaching openings that are not necessarily confirmed open yet, but we have some ideas for potential fits if they do become open shortly here. A lot of coaching carousel talk today, as well as playoff picks for the wild card round. But before we get to all that, EJ, how you doing?
Better than a lot of coaches. In this period, this day, this week, it is one of the most tumultuous times in the NFL for coaches, their families, for organizations. Massive amounts of changes going on. We hear a lot about the head coaches or even the coordinators that move on. And we don't hear about all the position coaches. We don't hear about all the strength coaches. We don't hear about all the people with sort of non-guaranteed livings that are affected in this week. So a lot of tumult, a lot of upset, a lot of storylines. We'll talk about most of those. I'm definitely not going to touch on all of them because, again, we're recording this on a Tuesday. Things are going to continue to change throughout the week. But we'll give you most of the ones we sort of have our eye on or we believe will shift. And then, like you said, we'll get into the playoffs. We'll pick a team for a reason. Give you a couple of our best hits if you want to jump into playoff best ball, get a little intel there, take your team to the win. We'll see about all that. Can't say after our showing in the regular season that we're infallible, but we'll give it our best shot.
You know, I finally started hitting on those entries towards the end of the year after I had
nice timing,
overwhelming data to use to my advantage. The first 14 weeks were not my friend, but you know, 15 through 18, we did pretty okay.
Better late than never.
Let's start with that open Titans job. Again, we are recording this roughly 2 to 3 hours after it was announced that Vrabel got fired. And we had heard rumblings for months, honestly, that this might be happening. But then Will Levis started playing well and, you know, you kind of look at the roster and you're like, okay, they have some issues, but like there are some really nice pieces and you got a young quarterback that looks promising. Like maybe they don't want to rock the boat and kind of, you know, hamper his potential development. Obviously, Vrabel is a great coach and everybody recognizes he's a great coach. Like maybe Will Levis kind of, I don't want to say coming out of nowhere, but coming on quicker than people expected would grant Vrabel another year to kind of get this thing going. Hopefully, you know, invest a lot in the offensive line next year. and that didn't happen. And I think that was what really surprised me is if this happened in October, I wouldn't have been shocked at all. The fact that it happened now, I was surprised by that, especially coming off a win against Jacksonville, a statement win against Jacksonville, who had everything to play for, and that game was not as close as the score indicated. Like, the Titans played their ass off for Mike Vrabel. That locker room wanted to win for Mike Vrabel, and they did. I know the Titans have said that they didn't trade Vrabel because trades can take a while to come together.
Yeah, and they thought it was going to take too long.
I go back and forth on that explanation. But, all right. Because theoretically, they couldn't make the trade until after the divisional round, I think. Like, the 21st, I think, is when they could have done a trade. But that's also when hires can be made anyway. So, like, they say, oh, we want to get interviews going and everything like that. And it's like, well, you have time. Like, they at least had maybe another 5 or 6 days to see if New England wanted to throw him a third rounder or something like that. Like, I'm not saying it would be a first rounder like in the Gruden trade, but I don't know. I don't want to say it's a panic move, but it kind of felt a little panicky, you know? And yeah,
I don't think it's panic. I think there are a couple of things to talk about, and I'll talk about sort of Vrabel and the Titans first, and then we'll talk about New England, because of course those two moves are connected no matter how you talk about them. So the first thing about Vrabel is, I think when the Titans moved on from Robinson as the GM last year, he thought he won. He thought it was his team. He thought he was going to be the voice in the building. And then they went out, hired Rand Carthen as a GM, who I like, and thought that's a nice addition. That's a cool new power couple. Vrabel and Carthen, I can see them seeing eye to eye on how to build a team and how to assess players. Certainly the mindset seemed very similar, and I thought, great, like, weird that they moved on from a GM in the middle of the season. We talked about that last year when it happened, as very, very odd timing. Almost never happens in the middle of a season. But I think Vrabel felt secure. Okay, it was a struggle between Robinson and I won, and now I'm the preeminent voice for the Titans in the building. And then he found out he wasn't. That's my theory, at least. I don't have anything to back that up, except for the fact he just got fired. So, seems like he probably wasn't the preeminent voice, probably wanted to be, and they probably said, no, we're going to make that voice Rand's voice. And I can see Vrabel not taking very kindly to that, especially with all he's achieved with that team. And basically his bona fides, his, you know, resume, which is impressive as an NFL coach. And I think he felt surprised. I think he probably felt slighted. And it's real easy in that situation for little things to become big things and for small irritants to become big fights. And I still didn't think it was going to happen. But now that it has happened, seems pretty clear to me that that's probably what went on in the building. Now, here's the bridge piece between Vrabel and New England, because those two pieces being linked. Everybody says Vrabel is a Belichick coach. Vrabel's not a Belichick coach. Vrabel was a Belichick player. He never coached for Belichick. He started very, like, visibly. He started his coaching journey outside that tree. And was not brought up with those coaches or that philosophy. Obviously, he's exposed to them as a player, sure, but he almost purposely did not start his coaching journey in New England. So everybody's saying, oh, it's Vrabel, he's a Belichick coach. He's not a Belichick coach, and he doesn't coach that way, quite frankly. He has some very different ideas. Now, is he a New England guy? Of course, he played there, had great success. He's well-loved in the community. Like, he is a New England guy, but he is not a Belichick coach. So that's the sort of bridge piece. And then, you know, what is he really going to bring to New England if he ends up there? Well, stabilizing influence. He's a hell of a football coach. That's the reason we're surprised this happened. We have seen him work magic in person, where there were games he should not have won that they won because of his resilience, because of what he instills in his players, because of his philosophy. Like, it ain't over. Keep grinding. Be physical. Play sound football. Like, it's not super exciting. And without a quarterback, the Titans were very, I will say, non-exciting. They still won games. They won games in a very sort of fundamental, sound, call it slightly old-fashioned way, but it was effective. It was really, really effective. And I think they got the most, for the most part, out of their roster. And that's all. Those are all really important features, which is, I think, a sum total of the reason were surprised that Tennessee rolled the dice and moved on, because you can certainly do a lot worse. I would say easily do a lot worse than Vrabel. No matter whether it's New England or somewhere else, he will not be unemployed for long. And I think he'll be a real asset to whichever organization he moves on to.
In terms of who's going to replace Vrabel, which is a tall, tall order.
Yeah.
I kind of going over candidates here, I look for two things. One, somebody young that isn't a big, bold personality, because apparently that's not what the Titans want. Like they apparently want Rancarthon to lead this thing and then have the coach kind of, I don't want to say a right-hand man, but it does seem like they want there to be kind of a hierarchy, right? Or else they would have let Vrabel stay. And so I think they want somebody young who, so not Jim Harbaugh, because boy, Jim Harbaugh is not built for this situation.
No.
And I think they want somebody on the offensive side that can come in and develop Will Levis. And so with those two criteria in mind, I think the best candidate, if I was the Titans, I don't want this to happen because it directly affects me. But I would hire Bobby Slowick, because not only does it help Will Levis, because Bobby Slowick is a great offensive coach, a young, energetic, innovative mind, you know, which is kind of the trend in the NFL is you go after the young guys on the offensive side of the ball, especially if they breathed anywhere near Kyle Shanahan in the last 10 years. But also it directly hurts Houston by taking him away from CJ Stroud. I think that's probably the best direction they could go for the franchise. Again, if it was me, I would have kept Vrabel. But with those die already cast, you got to do something here. And I think Slowick would be a good fit.
I like the Slowick pick. Obviously, Levis is their immediate future, and developing him should be the main priority, because without a quarterback, we all know that you're not going to win a lot in the NFL. I'm wondering, because again, we're surprised by this. So we thought they were good with where they were, and we thought we, quote unquote, knew what they wanted and had it in Vrabel. So there's a little bit of that lingering, I'll admit, to me. Like, do you want a leader of men? Do you want I don't want to say more CEO type. I don't love that. But do you want somebody to coach the whole team and make sure that, you know, everybody is on the same page and pulling together? Or is just the offensive develop most important? I mean, ideally you want both, but if you have to have one or the other, we both thought that Vrabel's job was safe because he was really good at that second part. He could pull everybody together, he could develop talent, and he could make sure that everybody played one way. Like the Titans never felt like a team where they were pulling themselves in different directions, whether it was offense or defense. Now, they didn't support each other in equal measure. The offense certainly, you know, didn't necessarily pull its weight after their playoff run with Tannehill kind of fell apart. We'll see. But I kind of feel like, oh, do they still want that? Do they still want a head guy? And if that's the case, I could see a guy like Mike McDonald, who is not an offensive guy, but does seem to be able to get his group of guys to play one way, one style, support each other, play really hard, be physical. I think that's going to be a hallmark. I think that was one of the reasons I liked Rancarthon as a GM, is he's going to bring in tough physical dudes, and Vrabel requires big, tough physical dudes for his system. And like Mike McDonald will know what to do with those guys. So there's this lingering piece of, but then there's the voice in the back of my head that says, they just fired that guy. They want something different. So I could see Slowick or Ben Johnson or Dave Canales or lots of the names we're going to talk about, anybody to come in and support Will Levis and really push him as far as he can go as a quarterback, which can then, if you surround him with some pieces, which the Titans need to do, we're going to talk about that all draft season long, that you can rebuild that offense to be more potent. There's going to be a lot of moves. I can see Derrick Henry moving on, Tajay Spears ascending to the RB1. Like, it's going to be Titans are going to have a different look here. So I can certainly see an offensive guy, and there's going to be that sort of triumvirate of offensive guys that are going to get all the interviews and, like you said, get all the spotlight in this process. And, you know, would probably be a good fit for the Titans. And it's just the one that they sit down with, because this is the important part that fans don't get, is when they sit down, there's got to be a mesh in that interview room. Like, how are you going to do this? We know you have a great resume on the offensive side, but how are you going to be a leader? How are you going to affect this? How are you going to mesh with Ran, who we've given a, you know, pretty serious you know, backing as the top guy in this spot. There has to be a mesh there. And I think that's where the surprises, quote unquote, surprises come out in the coaching hire and all these hires is you go, oh, but this guy seemed way more qualified for what they wanted. Look, they sat in the room and you hear it year after year. This guy sat down. He blew us away with his preparation, his approach, his fit. We felt like this was the guy to lead our team.
Speaking of big time hires that are getting all the attention, by the way, next up is the Chargers, who were either the first or the second team to I think Raiders fired McDaniels before Chargers Correct. Fired Staley. But you know, the job's been quote unquote open for a while. And yep. I think that was on purpose so that the Chargers could get way out in front in their search, right? And the one, and I say this not having any inside information, even though I do work with the Chargers, like I have not been told any of this explicitly. But there is kind of a groundswell across, it's called the NFL community, where everybody is
that what we're calling it?
Yeah, I mean, for lack of a better word, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, you and I are hearing it not from the same people, and mm-hmm. none of these people are connected to the Chargers, but like if they're hearing about it, like it's a thing, everybody's just chalking Jim Harbaugh to the Chargers at this point. Like everybody expects that to happen. I don't want to say it's the worst kept secret in football, but it's kind of the worst kept secret in football. They want him. He wants them. More specifically, he wants Justin Herbert because Justin Herbert is pretty good job security if you have a quarterback that good. You know, the Spanos family, you know, they had a reputation for not being big spenders when they were in San Diego. That is not the case since they've moved to L.A. They actually spend quite a bit. They spent a bunch of money on the defense. They gave Brandon Staley and Tom Telesco basically unlimited resources to try to build a functional defense. It just didn't happen. But like money wasn't the issue with this team. They spent a lot of money, and the Spanos family is still willing to spend a lot of money, which I would say for Chargers fans is nice because, again, that reputation Sure. was earned in San Diego of not being big spenders. So whatever dollar signs Jim Harbaugh wants, he's going to get. And he hired Don Yee last week, I think, specifically to get those dollar signs because that's what Don Yee does is he gets NFL coaches big-time deals. And, of course, they just won the national championship last night. So Jim's kind of accomplished everything that he needs to accomplish in college football. You know, he beat Ohio State 3 times in a row. He won a natty, arguably the greatest Michigan team of all time. They went 15-0. First undisputed championship since the 40s, I think it was. Like, he did the damn thing, okay? Like, he doesn't need to stay at Michigan. He's going to go back to the NFL. He's going to try to win a Super Bowl, be one of the few coaches ever to be a champion everywhere. He would be the first one since, I think, Jimmy Johnson to accomplish that off the top of my head. So I think the Chargers make a lot of sense for him. We know he loves California. A lot of his coaching jobs have been in the Western time zone. And when you already have Justin Herbert there, you have a top 5 pick, you have owners that are willing to spend, it just makes sense. And that's why everybody within, again, the NFL community, I guess you can say, is like not even looking at any other candidate. They're all just like, oh yeah, Jim's a Charger. Anyway, where's Mike McDonald going to go? Like, that's kind of where the conversation is right now. And I think I agree with it.
There's a lot of smoke, and I would say it's real because, again, we're hearing it from different people with different details, but they're all pointing the same way. And I think what we need to do is separate the smoke from the desire, because anybody that is a fan of a team that either has an open head coaching spot or thinks their head coaching spot is going to be open, there is a section of their fan base that is clamoring for Harbaugh. And that is desire. That is, I want, you know, mm-hmm. I want several million dollars in my bank account does not mean it's going to happen anytime soon. And I think we have to separate that desire from what we're hearing from lots of different sources that does line up, right? We know he loves being in California. We know that he would like an established offensive piece. We know that he is largely heralded and has a resume. Everywhere he's been as a culture changer, called a tone setter, tone changer. And if ever there was a team that needed a culture reset, a tone change, it's the Chargers. They've tried a lot of things. It hasn't worked. We thought it was going to work this year. We could say that about a lot of previous years with the Chargers. It hasn't. They need a new path. Harbaugh is good at that. He just reached the top of the mountain in his previous spot. And I say previous with him even today coming out and saying, no, I'm going to be at Michigan next year, which for me is the death knell, right? Whenever there's that. 6 weeks ago, the Titans said, oh, no, Vrabel's in our plans long term. He's gone. Like, Harbaugh's going to say what he's going to say. He's going to do what he's going to do. He's going to hire high-powered agent who's very well respected, who is going to get him paid as a top NFL coach, and he is going to presumably move to California, change the tone for the Chargers, and we'll see how it goes. But there's a lot of fans out there that don't want to believe that because they have a desire that he's going to be their head coach, not the Chargers head coach.
You're just taking shots at Chicago right now, aren't you?
No, I've heard it from Raiders fans.
Bears Twitter,
he's a Raider. He's this. You know, like any team with an opening right now. I've heard New England, which I would, that would be one of the later stops for Harbaugh in a coaching tour if he was taking one. The bottom line is he's not taking one. It's either going to work out with the Chargers or it's not, and then he'll be available to somebody else. But that's the way that's going to happen. It's not open bidding. And I think fans of teams want it to be. They want it to be, oh, they're all equal and our owner has a better offer than your own. No, this particular situation fits with Harbaugh in several ways that we know that he is after, that he wants, that he craves. And as long as the money works out, yeah, he's probably going to be a Charger.
The bigger question, honestly, is who's going to be the GM? You know, with Tom Telesco gone. And there's a lot of hot candidates that you're hearing about right now. One that I believe they actually did request an interview with is Alec Hallaby, who's the Eagles' assistant general manager. He's been in Philly for 16 years. So, you know, being one of Howie's top lieutenants for a decade and a half, it's a pretty good resume considering the roster that the Eagles have built four times over at this point. It feels like that team gets completely remade every 3 or 4 years, and Hallaby's been a part of all those rebuilds and all those different, you know, stylistic changes, all the different regimes. Like, he was there for all of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I specifically single him out as a good candidate because if there's one thing that Howie and all of his guys prioritize, it's trench warfare. And if there's one thing that Jim Harbaugh loves, it's trench warfare. So I kind of think that they would be on the same page of, like, every single year, no matter what the need is, it's going to be who's the best offensive lineman or defensive lineman on the board. Let's take him. And we'll figure out the rest on day two. And even though the Chargers, like Chargers fans specifically, are just over the moon for Malik Nabers right now at the fifth overall pick. And believe me, sure, I would love that. Like, you could talk me into Malik Nabers at five instantly. I'm on board. I wouldn't hate that pick. I do feel like if Jim comes in and if Hallaby comes in, they're going to look at Joe Alt and be like, yeah, that's a 10-year Charger. And I think that they would be in lockstep on that kind of decision. And then they would get receiver on day two. But I do think that, especially with somebody like Jim Harbaugh, you need to have a GM that thinks the way that Jim thinks. And that, to me, is Alec Hallaby.
He's also got a strong analytics background, numbers-based background, and a lot of people would say that's kind of anti-Harbaugh. They see him as a very old-school coach. He came around to that approach, and it led him to the change at Michigan over the last 3 years. He came to embrace data in a way that he hadn't. He came to understand that it played a part and was not something to be shunned. But yeah, Harbaugh wants dudes. He had dudes when he was in San Francisco. he filled the Michigan roster with dudes. They're, you know, they're probably, I think, second in the CFB behind like Penn State, you know, maybe Texas of like every year
just
Michigan's
like got athletic
testers, yeah. strength, five stars, just every year Feldman's freak list has a couple of Wolverines on it, very highly placed, that are just like, oh my God, did you see what that guy did? Like, there's no reason to think that if he ends up with the Chargers, that approach is going to be any different. And Howie's very, you know, familiar with that from what Howie's done in Philadelphia. Both their offensive and defensive lines are stacked with dudes. It's not going to be a foreign concept to him. And he's not going to like chafe at like, oh, we need receiver talent. He knows you can get receiver talent. He knows you need it, but there are multiple ways. Even the Eagles have got it in multiple ways. AJ Brown was not drafted as an Eagle, but he ended up there. So he's going to have that sort of well-rounded perspective about how to build a team. But yes, I'm with you. He's got sort of lockstep with, I'll just say, Harbaugh-isms. And that will be a fast start for the Chargers.
Let's move on to the Raiders. Keep it in the AFC West. Again, I'm not 100% sure that it's going to happen, but I have to assume you and I agree that, like, Antonio Pierce and Champ Kelly should be option number one, right? Like that, they got to keep them both.
If it's me, yes. Like AP did a tremendous job, and you know we thought the last interim coach of the Raiders did a really good job, and he did. AP did a better job with arguably a worse or very similar at best, some, you know, situation. And the way that the Chargers team changed fundamentally the day he took it over. There were a lot of good vibe stories coming out of Las Vegas. And we're like, yeah, let's see what happens. And then we saw what happened over the last half of the season. And if you have those results, it kind of feels like Vrabel to me. You have a demonstrated thing. You have a demonstrated winner. I guess I shouldn't say this because they just fired Vrabel, but we thought they should have kept him. We really think they should keep AP because the players responded to him. The team played better. They got more out of talent that they had been getting less out of. Again, the guys didn't change. It was mid-season. It's as apples to apples a comparison as you're ever going to get. And Pierce did such a better job with the talent that was in the building than the previous coach did that I think if you're not going to do that, you open yourself up to a lot of risk. Like, there's always risk in a coaching change. I would say an exceptional amount of risk because you already have the bird in the hand. You know what this guy can do with this group of players. There's no better sort of interview in the world than that. And Champ Kelly, I'm really surprised they haven't sort of already minted him. And you and I talked about reasons pre-podcast that might be happening. There are things that the Raiders have to satisfy in terms of the hiring process, but Champ Kelly was the guy 2 or 3 years ago for any personnel opening. Like, he was the guy getting interviewed, and he came from Chicago. He was the guy getting all those interviews. And, you know, we don't have, I would say, an equally stark sort of resume from him because not a lot of personnel moves get made in the back half of the season. We don't have a draft from him specifically. We have lots and lots and lots of experience, and he's got lots and lots of experience. So I think it's a better than average chance that he would do a good job. And as long as he and AP are, again, in lockstep, because that's one of the most important relationships in the building, if not the most important, between GM and head coach, I'm a little surprised they haven't locked this up. And I think the only reason maybe that they haven't is because they do need to satisfy all the due diligence requirements before they go, nope, we got our guys. They're right here. We had them for the second half of the season. We'd like to keep them.
I mean, it's basically a job interview, like the last 9 games or whatever, where AP is.
Fully agree.
Like that's basically the job interview right there. And he nailed it. You couldn't really nail it any better than he nailed it, considering the roster. Nope. And the situation and where the team was when, yep, he took over. You know, short of them like hiring Bill Belichick himself, and even then, at considering Bill's age and, you know, maybe,
yeah, and whether or not he's going to give up control for GM, which is a huge thing we'll talk about with wherever Belichick gets mentioned. Yeah, you got two guys that are working with a roster that you already have in the building. You, I would say, overachieved for the last half of the season. Like, yeah,
that's it.
Give those guys a swing at a draft and free agency and make the team a little bit better, like the roster a little bit better, and then see what happens.
And I think also another factor here that Mark Davis is going to be considering, two thoughts here, actually, because I know there is a there was a couple people noting of like, oh, he's not going to go after any of like the quote unquote more expensive candidates because he's paying a bunch of money to Josh McDaniels and there's the Gruden thing and like, no. OK, Mark Davis has more money now than you think. Like, this is a
they
team
are
that,
printing money in Las
dude,
Vegas. Not
the Raiders
just on
make
the strip,
more money like, than anybody else. Like,
right.
Like they have the highest revenue in the NFL. Like,
yeah. Once they lit up Allegiant and fans travel to Allegiant, we've talked about this many times on the podcast, that the place is always full because even if Raiders fans weren't selling it out, which they probably would be, the other team's fans are coming in and snapping up all the remaining seats because they get to go hang out in Las Vegas and watch their team play. Like, the Raiders are printing money. The Super Bowl's in Vegas this year. Like, forget it. The team share of what the Raiders have to get, I mean, their facility in Henderson, their practice facility is one of the coolest buildings I've ever been in on earth. Like, it's a really, really cool place. They got cash. They're good.
Yeah, money is not a factor. And so if they wanted to give Jim Harbaugh $15 million, they could. They wouldn't even blink.
Sure.
Now, again, I think Harbaugh's a Charger, but I'm just saying hypothetically, like, they would not, quote unquote, settle for AP because AP would be cheaper than Harbaugh. Money's not the reason. They would hire AP because AP's the guy for the job. And I think another factor here is Mark Davis vividly remembers what happened when his entire locker room was saying, please hire Rich Bisaccia. We love Rich Bisaccia. This is our guy. We play for him. And then he hired the exact opposite in Josh McDaniels. The vibes immediately went out the window. Nobody wanted to be there. And the team tanked. And then they got AP in there. And all of a sudden the locker room, who knew, started playing up to their potential again because they actually liked going into work every day. I think that's a lesson that Mark Davis probably learned from, and I don't think he's going to ignore his players again. You know, when you got Devontae and Max and, you know, every veteran on the team basically saying like, there's your guy, Mark, like, I think he's gonna listen. I really do. So again, I'm like 95% sure he's gonna be the guy, and I hope that both of them are. The Panthers are in a very
different
very,
spot.
Very different spot. Moving on to our next team here in Carolina. They remind me so much of where the Texans were a few years mm-hmm. ago. And so my first message to Panthers fans is it can get better. Okay, it absolutely can get better. Once upon a time, the Texans were staring down the barrel of recycling coaches on one-year deals over and over again because nobody wanted to go there, and there was questions about ownership and everything was toxic. You know, the Jack Easterby situation, it was toxic. Like, that's the best word to describe it. Nobody wanted to go there. And next thing you know, Easterby, thank God for Lovie Smith, Easterby gets removed, so the toxicity is gone. You know, they get CJ Stroud, they have $74 million in cap space, they make the playoffs in a year that honestly they weren't supposed to. And this is the most optimistic that Texans fans have been since at least 2011. You know, like that's where the franchise is right now, when 3 years ago they were exactly where the Panthers are right now. So it can get better, but it requires David Tepper to go away. And I don't mean sell the team, although I'm sure Panthers fans would be okay with that. I just mean go away. Like, he can't keep being the story. Like, he really can't, because the more he is the story, and especially when those stories are negative, the less likely it is that Ben Johnson wants to come coach the team, or Bobby Slowick, or any of the top candidates, let alone Jim Harbaugh. Like, they're not going to get one of those guys, because why would anybody, especially a young coach with their first opportunity, and they got to make sure they get a good job here that they can last at. Like, why would they go to Carolina? They don't have the first overall pick. They don't have receivers. The offensive line's a mess. Bryce Young looks broken. The owner's an asshat. Why would they go there? And I don't think they will. And so my pick for fit for Carolina is not the best coach that's available, but it is kind of a realistic one that they might end up with. And that's going to be either Leslie Frazier or Wink Martindale. Because if the Panthers are going to hire somebody, it's probably going to be like what the Texans had to do a few years ago and hire somebody who wouldn't get hired anywhere else, i.e. their own version of David Culley.
Yeah.
Which is probably Leslie Frazier at this point.
That was the name that came up when we started talking about this. As I said, this reminds me of the David Culley situation. And David Culley did a great job for the Texans. This is not David Culley slander. I think he exceeded every expectation for the situation that he walked into, but he was not the first choice. Like, he was the guy that would take the job, and the Panthers, make no mistake, are at a place where they need the guy that will take the job. And that is not the best guy, because the best guys are going to have better offers, and it doesn't have to do anything with money. David Tepper's got more money than God. He could pay whatever he wanted to. That's not the point. The point is right now it's a toxic situation with limited resources and a sort of large rebuilding job. And, you know, don't fret, Panthers fans. Somebody's going to take the job. There's only 32 of them. Somebody will believe they can fix it. Will it be one of the top 8 or 10 guys? Not on your life. I don't care what they promise them. This league talks. This is a very insular league. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows what it's like in that building right now. And nobody really wants to go there because they know that right now, it's barring a kind of massive change, they've got an owner who is going to be an involved owner. And sometimes that's a good thing. And a lot of times it's not a good thing. And it's really not a good thing right now. So they are going to have to go for somebody that wants a job that wouldn't otherwise get it, who says, look, I'll take my chances. I know it's not great. It's a lot like Ron Rivera going to the Commanders, knowing that Dan Snyder was going to be a problem and was going to influence his daily life. And he was going to go in and do the best he could. That's the kind of candidate that's going to end up in Carolina, which is ironic because Rivera came from Carolina to go to the Commanders. But that's what's going to happen for the next Panthers head coach. Is it's probably not going to be somebody you expect, certainly not going to be somebody off the top of the watch list. It is going to be somebody, and we'll see what happens. We'll see if Tepper learns any lessons. Doesn't look like he is right now, but people can change. And we will probably see another change within this organization at head coach within a couple of years.
For the GM position, similar kind of story. And I look at GM candidates, I'm not saying that this candidate is bad. I actually quite like him. But they might have to look for a candidate that wants either a second bite at the apple that they might not get elsewhere, or somebody who just deeply desires a chance. And for me, that's Brian Gain, who's the Bills assistant GM, former Texans GM. And it's kind of ironic because he himself got ran out of town by Jack Easterby, didn't really get a real shot at being the Texans GM. He's only there for 2 years. And so he was a victim of toxicity before. Well, I don't know. There's kind of debates about what was actually going on in the building at that time, but I can't imagine it was a good situation if a GM only lasts for 2 years there, when we never really heard anything about clashes with ownership or anything like that. Like, I believe that he became one of, you know, Jack Easterby's targets at the time. Sure. And so, you know, I think he's wanted to get a second shot here because he feels like maybe he didn't get a real one in Houston. And I think that out of all the potential GM candidates, and again, Bill's roster, even with all their injuries, like, they got the 2 seed in the AFC. Like, the man can help build a good, deep roster, right? So he is a good candidate, but he's also, I think, one of the most realistic candidates that Carolina might attract at this point.
You need a paradox, and that's hard. You need somebody that's got a strong voice and strong opinions about personnel and is also willing to relinquish that control to an owner who is going to be involved. And when the owner says, we're not doing that, you got to give it up. And that's a hard line to straddle, to say, no, I'm committed. I'm going to bang the table. I believe in this approach or this guy or this group of guys. And an owner comes in and says, not this one, not this one, not this one. And you go, I feel like my professional expertise sets me up to make that choice better than you, but it's your money. Okay, we're going that way. And you have to be happy in that situation too, because being a GM anywhere, and I don't care whether it's in the NFL, they have them in college now, CFL, the new United Football League, like I don't care. Like it is a long job. It's a lot of work. It's mostly behind the scenes. There's not a lot of glory in it. You have to love the work and you have to be happy to go to work to do that kind of demanding job. And it can be deflating when you do all that work and have your rationales and believe you have your arguments in place, and an owner says somewhat willy-nilly, no, like, I don't like the look of that. So we're not doing it. So you got to have somebody that can straddle that line. They're going to have to, as long as David Tepper is there. He's been very involved, especially in the draft process and the draft theory, all the trade downs they did the first year he was there. It's an area of interest for him. He thinks there's market inequities there that he can take advantage of. And as a GM, you're going to have to accommodate that. So it's a, I don't want to say it's unique, but it's a rare skill set that they're looking for. You got to sort of be half and half about it.
Moving on to Atlanta, and this whole situation fascinates me down there because the roster isn't bad. Like, they're not bad. Like, they were not coached very well. Well, at least on the offensive side of the ball. Defensive side of the ball, I thought they were coached pretty well. Like, obviously, I think Arthur Smith had a bad year as a head coach. And, well, more than one bad year. This team finished with the 8th overall pick 3 years in a row. But I don't think that this roster is so talent deficient that they should have been the 8th overall pick. And how often do you see a team that's playing potentially for a playoff spot in the last week and then still finish with the 8th overall pick? Like, they're a weird organization that did not perform up to their talent level. And I think when the Falcons are trying to replace Arthur Smith, their main goal is to find a head coach that can maximize the talent that they do have. And boy, they do have talent. And also at the same time, let's say a move is made for Justin Fields, they need to get a guy.
Because of course we can't say the Falcons without saying Justin Fields this time of year.
I'm just saying.
It's against the rules. It's against the rules.
Everybody drink. but I have to imagine that's in consideration of who can we get in here if we're making a move either for Justin or say we're doing a big old trade up for Jaden Daniels or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or if we drop down a few spots and it's Bo Nix season. Like, again, they're going to get another quarterback. We just don't know which one.
Yep.
You know, you got to get a head coach who could potentially maximize said quarterback because Desmond Ridder ain't it. So in your view, with all the candidates on the table that might potentially fit that criteria, if you were Arthur Blank, who's your guy?
Be looking at all the offensive coaches, but I'd also want somebody that has experience with a quarterback that fits somewhat outside the lines. And to me, it's probably Eric Bieniemy, because if we're going to talk about Justin Fields, and clearly we are, you bring Justin Fields in, you have a lot of other offensive pieces. Again, you're not making Justin the centerpiece of that offense. He's another valuable weapon. Bieniemy worked with Mahomes as a young quarterback who was not a, despite all his success and revisionist history and in the box quarterback prospect, he was a very out of the box quarterback prospect, ton of skills, big resume, but also a lot of things that needed to be adapted to play that well in the NFL. Fields, you could say, fits that description to a lesser extent, but also doesn't have to be the guy. He has to be better. And again, I think Bieniemy can maximize some of the things that he brings, hopefully minimize some of the things that have held him back. But again, you're throwing to Drake London. You've got Bijan toting the rock. You've got an offensive line. You've got Kyle Pitts. You've got guys. You're going to add even more guys. Your defense, as you said, is not terrible. It was pretty well coached. bring in a solid defensive coach. Bieniemy's been a coach in the league for a long time. He's got a lot of friends around the league. I think he could fill that bill. He could make a staff pretty easily. And Atlanta could be one of those teams that doesn't make the playoffs the year before, does the next year, has a pretty substantial turnaround because what they do have in the building wasn't being maximized. And if you can get that offense clicking, you got a shot.
Looking at a lot of the work that that EB did in Washington this year, I mean, clearly he got a lot of blood from the stone in terms of, you know, at least passing production. I was frustrated that, you know, Jahan Dotson wasn't involved as I thought he could have or should have been this year.
Share something with Falcons fans. Wait, offensive players aren't being used to their potential?
Oh, no. Maybe Eric Bieniemy's going to make Jonnu Smith a 100-catch receiver. Maybe this isn't a good idea. overall, at least there was, like, productivity. You know, it wasn't to Jahan Dotson. It was more to Curtis Samuel and insert tight end of the week here. But there was productivity. There was a method to the madness for EB. Everything got spread around a lot. And it felt like every single week there was a new leading receiver in Washington, right? And also, you know, again, we like Sam Howell, but Sam Howell is not an upper echelon quarterback in the NFL. And at least at one point this year, they were top five in passing yards per game, you know? So that's a pretty impressive achievement, I would say, by EB. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, nobody questions his ability in the locker room. Like, you look at how the players talk about him. They look up to him. They love him as a leader. Like, I think that this would be a great time to prove his chops as a head coach. I would also love to see him, you know, maybe poach some Kansas City assistants as well. Because I think that part of being a great head coach is also hiring good assistants. But I think EB can absolutely do that as well. My one other candidate that I think kind of fits the bill here is probably the main one that Falcons fans want. And that's, of course, going to be Ben Johnson from Detroit. I don't really think they can go wrong here as long as they're hiring one of these offensive guys. They can come in here and take the talent that they've very deliberately drafted in the top 10 year after year after year, all the skill position talent, all the investment they made in the offensive line. Like, as long as they're bringing in somebody who can maximize that talent with less spitefulness and less disdain for Falcons fans, I guess, than Arthur Smith.
Gestures everywhere. Like, it doesn't matter if it's like a player that played on your college team that wasn't being used. Like, everybody was mad at Arthur Smith. Fantasy players, college fans, like Texas fans hated that Bijan was stuffed down the roster. I think, you know, folks that like Kyle Pitts in college had given up and gone off drinking. Like, everybody's mad at Arthur Smith.
I think the only person on earth that hates Falcons fans more than Saints fans is Arthur Smith. Like, that man had some hatred in his heart for for everybody who dared to question his personnel usage.
But and it's be like, prepared,
dude.
he's gonna be the OC for Vrabel. Be prepared, it's gonna happen.
I didn't even think about that.
I would be stunned, quite frankly, if Vrabel landed pretty much anywhere and Smith was not his OC. And it worked in Tennessee. I mean, for all the bad taste of, you know, the Falcons head coaching gig, you have to remember he was one of the hottest head coaching candidates because of what he did with Tannehill in the year he took him to the playoffs. Like, that Tennessee offense was overachieving.
But he ignored the lessons from that offense, where it's like, hey, you've got Derrick Henry, use Derrick Henry. You've got AJ Brown, use AJ Brown. Preaching, like, he ignored all that.
To the choir. Yeah, he wanted to be the smartest guy in the room, and that guy is usually the most dangerous. If he has a strong head coach, and I think we both agree that Mike Vrabel is one of the strongest head coaches in terms of personality in the league, above him saying, yo, guess what? We drafted Bijan for a reason. Get to it. That could probably work because it did in Tennessee. So I'm just trying to prepare everybody. I'm not saying it's great or people are going to love it or anything else. The results are probably going to be better. I think Arthur Smith pretty clearly is going to be one of those guys that's a better coordinator than head coach. He might get a second bite at the apple. Well, you never can tell. But right now, like when he goes back to being an OC, I think the general opinion of him around the league is going to raise. Again, it can't go much lower, right, than it is right now. So we'll see.
Finishing it off with the Washington Commanders, where EB just was. I would say, again, top priority, we're assuming they're going to take a quarterback at the second overall pick. They'd be dumb not
yes.
to. Top priority is bringing in a head coach that can develop said young quarterback, whether it's Caleb, whether it's May, whether it's Jaden Daniels. We have 3 more months to debate who that actually is, right? Because there's people mm-hmm. out there who say that Caleb is not QB1. There's people out there who say May is not QB2. And I still haven't even decided for myself where I have these guys.
No.
But it's safe to say that they're going to take one of them. And so getting a coach in there that can develop them and to maximize, develop them quickly, I should say, so that they can maximize that rookie contract window is imperative. For me, that's Dave Canales. And of course, yes, obviously, Ben Johnson, another candidate too. But if we don't want to just talk about Ben Johnson all day, it's going to be Dave Canales. Looking at what Dave Canales has done the last 2 years in terms of, you know, resurrecting the careers of both Baker Mayfield and Geno Smith in back-to-back years mm-hmm. and making them both a lot of money. Like, Baker's probably going to get 3 years, $90 to $100 million this offseason. Geno Smith got a $100 million deal last year. Like, Dave Canales is a huge reason why both of their careers got essentially saved, because his offensive philosophy, I don't want to say it holds the hand of the quarterback. It doesn't hold the hand of the quarterback. But how his passing concepts fit together from a structural perspective just makes sense. Like, it's very much like Todd Monken in Baltimore, who's also getting a bunch of interviews because, of course, he is.
Sure.
But you're looking at how his routes fit together with protections and how he, you know, strings play calls together, you know, calling stuff in the first quarter that's going to set up stuff in the third quarter, you know, how he kind of plays with pace to keep defenses off balance in certain areas of the field, like when he goes up tempo, when he slows it down. Like, he's just such a naturally instinctive both play caller and designer of offense. Like, I really do think he's one of those guys. And the proof is in the pudding that he had, you know, playoff caliber offenses with two quarterbacks that everybody had written off, like completely mm-hmm. written off in Geno Smith and Baker Mayfield. And also, he really knows how to maximize big, fast receivers. Not that Terry McLaurin's like the biggest guy out there, but if you need an OC, you know, he's fast. If you need an OC that can find a million different ways to give Terry McLaurin one-on-one, like, Dave Canales will do it. He will find ways to get Terry one-on-one. And if you also package that together with May or Caleb or Jaden Daniels, and you say, okay, here's this incredible receiver out there, I'm going to do my job of getting you favorable looks, you do your job of getting him the ball, like, this team can work. It can absolutely work. So I think Dave Canales would be a wonderful hire for them. I know a lot of fans are not paying attention to him whatsoever, but they absolutely should. And mm-hmm. even if he doesn't get hired in DC, like, I would gladly take him at most of the destinations we've already talked about, because I think he is a very good football coach.
Two things I love about Canales. The first thing is every quarterback has an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other. And both Geno and Baker were known for listening more to one or too much to one and not to the other. And it's like Canales can put a little glass box over that negative side of whatever quarterback play is and go, no, no, just listen to this side. And he did it with Geno. A lot of the habits that Geno had that were not great, a lot of the negatives that were attached to his game, and rightfully so, he kept him away from, and he let the other side shine, right? He just got that side quiet, and he let the other side shine. And then I think he had a bigger job to do with Baker because Baker had more starting experience and, quite frankly, a higher variance than Geno did. Geno had never really hit the heights. Baker had hit some heights, but he'd hit big negatives and big positives. And so I think it was an even tougher challenge, and he was just as effective as he was with Geno in sort of, again, putting a glass box over that negative part of your game and saying, these are all the good parts of your game. Let's just play those. Like, let's make this happen. Let's make it so you can make choices to just let this happen. And lo and behold, we got to see good Baker for most of the year. I would say the vast majority of the year. I think that would make him a great head coaching candidate. I also, and this is sort of like wind the clock back, again, revisionist history, I would love to see what he could do with Sam Howell. Not as a starter. I'm not saying as his number one. I definitely think Washington should take a quarterback at number two. Let's just put that up front. But like, of all the guys to say, hey, there's a lot of good parts about your game. Let's quiet the negative parts down, because that's what really ran Sam Howell out of that opportunity. It doesn't even have to be next year. It doesn't have to be in Washington, but like Dave Canales with Howell, there's so many good things to work with there. And he's such a quarterback whisperer in terms of being able to shut down all those negative parts of the game. And let's be honest, if you shut down the interceptions with Sam Howell, you've got a top 15 quarterback. Like,
and the sacks. Like, that's the big thing. If he can just teach Sam Howell, and it got better over the back half of the year, but like, if he could just teach Sam Howell to not take sacks over and over and over and over and over again, like, that would have fixed a lot of the problems.
Yeah, too many interceptions, too many sacks. But again, we could say all the negative things about Baker's game before this year. We could say a lot of negative things about Geno's game before the last 2 years. Dave Canales is the thing in common between those two guys really sort of hitting that stride that every fan wants their favorite player to hit, which is do all the good things and do less of the bad things. And Canales is able to make that happen with quarterbacks. So he would be a great choice. And then I really think Slowik, again, with taking a young quarterback in CJ Stroud and making him work very quickly. And again, spreading around to offensive weapons, which they do have in Washington, would make him a logical choice for this, especially since we know they're going to be picking a young quarterback with number two.
There's an interesting GM candidate that they put in a request to interview yesterday. That's Bears assistant GM Ian Cunningham. Yeah. I'm not super familiar with him myself. And even though the Bears have had their fair share of swings and misses in the draft over the last several years, they also potentially got a starting left tackle in the fifth round. They've got, you know, a very good guard in Tevin Jenkins, potentially a very good right tackle long-term in Darnell Wright. You know, they got Jalen Johnson. You know, I have to assume he gave some input on the trade that netted them DJ Moore and all the assets from Carolina. You know, Cole Kmet started out rocky, but ended up being a pretty serviceable tight end. Javon Dexter has so far has been a great pick. Billings was a great pickup. I mean, you go down the line of Bears roster,
Tyree Stevenson, like,
there's dudes there. Like, this Bears team, you know, over the back half of the year was seventh highest in the NFL in terms of weighted DVOA as a team. Like, there's guys. And I think that Ian Cunningham, to whatever involvement he had in that, like, yeah, requesting to interview somebody who helped put together that kind of roster, as disappointing as it was in the first half of the year, like, you saw the potential of what it could do in the back half of the year. And I think like those last nine games are really what's gotten a lot of people excited about the Bears, and more specifically about Bears personnel people.
Yeah, Ian Cunningham was getting interviews last year. He was, again, one of those guys in the process of the GM process. Everybody thought it was a little bit early, but also, like, hey, this guy's on the come up. He's going to get him. If we get him early this year, maybe he's a little bit green, but we get him. Whereas if we let him go another year, I don't think he'll be with the Bears for what will amount to be a third year under Poles. He is probably going to get a job in this cycle, and rightfully so. Again, you saw a lot of the younger players, especially from the last draft, but really the last two drafts. You saw Kyler Gordon play better. Jaquan Brisker's played really well when he's been on the field, but injuries have been a thing this year with Darnell Wright, and then Stevenson and Dexter really starting to come on later in the year. Like, people went, oh, like, wait, they are developing young players. They did pick ones that fit their system. Okay. And also free agency choices, some low-key moves, some hierarchy moves like DJ. Ian Cunningham's a well-respected guy. He's been in several different personnel shops, so he has a variety, a diversity of experience about how to build a team. He's well-respected. He's highly intelligent. Definitely, from what I've heard, speaks very well when he sits in a room and is very clear at articulating his vision. So I do think he's a guy that probably won't get out of this round. And GM openings are a little weird because there's less of them every year, and they're a little bit, I would say, less predictable just because they're less visible. Owners want maybe different things that are less measured or less easily measured than things that they want out of coaches. So, but Cunningham, super well respected, could build a staff again because he's been in multiple front offices, very intelligent, and has a pretty good track record as a young, we'll just call him assistant GM. I think he's primed. I would like to see him back with the Bears, again, in a selfish way, just like the way you'd like to see Slowick back with the Texans as a coach. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. I think he hooks on. There's more openings this year for GM than there typically are, and Cunningham was a guy that was already getting looks last year. I think he latches one of those spots this year.
All right, well, that wraps up all the discussion that we probably can have about coaching changes to this point until we get a better idea of how many spots are going to be open. And sure, who knows? You know, I don't think Nick Sirianni's out of the woods either. So we'll see how that goes after their game against Tampa this weekend. And if he ends up, or McCarthy or whoever, if there's another like surprise firing based on like an embarrassing playoff loss in the first round, we'll address that next week. But for now, that's about all we can really touch on based on the information that we have. And speaking of those wild card predictions, even though we're like an hour 15 into this show, we couldn't end this show without at least submitting some picks for these games this weekend. So EJ, I'll give you the floor first. Pittsburgh, Buffalo, who's your pick?
I've got Buffalo with the role they're on. I think that takes them over the Steelers. They have better balance right now than the Steelers do. They have easily the better quarterback. Daquan Jones is going to help blunt Najee through the middle, which is really something the Steelers leaned on to get to this place. I just don't think Steelers have the horsepower, especially with Watt out for the game, most likely. I'm going to take Buffalo.
Yeah, I got Buffalo as well. TJ is such a difference maker for this team, and I would have given them a puncher's chance if Watt was there, because how this team typically wins games is they just kind of survive until TJ or Highsmith, you know, flips the field on a crazy sack that results in a huge loss. Then you got a punt, and all of a sudden, you know, insert Steelers quarterback here, because they've had three of them this year. You know, we'll start at like the 40-yard line. They get a shorter, an easier starting field position so they can get points on the board. Or they just outright force a turnover and give like a free red zone possession, like what happened in the Rams game. Like, that's how this team wins, is they get a big defensive play that the offense has to try really hard not to fuck up. And that's worked for most of the year. However, without TJ Watt on the field, I have less confidence that big defensive play is going to happen. Like, he's not their only pass rusher, obviously. They got a bunch of them, but he is the best one. He's the most impactful one. He's the one that has kind of a nose for turning the ball over and just making a big play when they absolutely need it. He's one of the only defensive players in the league that I think moves the needle that much that I don't think they have a shot without him. So I'm going to go with Buffalo. As inconsistent as they've been this year, they're also a team that tends to have a puncher's chance, but they actually have their punchers on the field. So I'll go with them. Miami KC, keep in mind, This game is going to be cold, cold, cold. We're talking like minus 17 wind chill projected at kickoff. This is not a Dolphins team that typically wins in cold weather. They've gone 0 for 10 in their last 10 games below 40 degrees. Do you think they break that streak?
No. We're talking about KC in roughly Siberian conditions. We're talking about 17 below. We're talking about up to 20 mile an hour gusts to go with this. This is not just cold and still. This is cold, windy, blowy. Like, if you could draw up conditions that you wanted to slow Miami down with, this or a super muddy field are probably the two things that you would call up on. And with the Chiefs D at home, look, I think the fish freeze and their run ends. I think it's kind of unfair. They've had a great season. They've achieved a lot. This is a bad draw. Losing that game to Buffalo flipped it, so they didn't have to play Buffalo again. They had to play KC in these conditions. If they win, I'll actually be surprised.
I would be genuinely shocked, right? Because this game plays into KC's hand so well. Now, another factor here that maybe people aren't talking about as much, because, you know, obviously KC's passing game is not good this year. And if we're just talking about passing game versus passing game, like, the Dolphins have a huge advantage. But the Dolphins have struggled with drops as it is, let alone when they're trying to catch an actual brick, which is what that ball is going to feel like.
Yep.
And at that point, it comes down to, you know, who can run the ball better. And yes, obviously, the Dolphins have a dynamic run game. But with the way that KC matches up with their run defense versus the Dolphins' rushing offense, you know, with all the two high structures that they tend to play, it actually kind of does give them a schematic advantage against all the outside zone and all the pin and pulls and everything that Miami relies on. Because when you're in a middle field open structure and your safeties are wider, it actually makes it easier in terms of, like, pursuit angles to get outside and to generate tackles for loss and everything like that. I would be more concerned for the run game matchup if KC was like a middle field closed dominant defense, like, say, the Colts, right? But the fact that they spend most of their time in quarters and quarter half, like, their safeties just have better angles here. And so a lot of what the Dolphins do well, I don't like that matchup, especially in the cold and especially when they can't complement it with their passing game, because receivers are going to, like, I'm trying to really emphasize here how hard it's going to be to catch the ball and how hard it's going to be to kick the ball too. Like, I almost would, any field goal over 40 yards, like, I'm not doing it. Like, it's got to be in the 30s. Or I'm not kicking.
And it's already snowed there. It snowed a bunch today, so it's not just really, really cold. It's not just windy. It's very possible it's either going to be actively snowing or blowing snow, certainly, because there's already snow on the ground. Like, this is going to be full-on blizzard bowl, and I don't like what that does to the Dolphins' chances.
It's unfortunate, because I think inside, like, even on a neutral field, like, not even in Miami, like, neutral field inside, I'd probably take Miami. But that's not what they're getting. It's not the hand they were dealt, you know.
If you want better conditions,
beat Buffalo.
Yeah. Well, you got to win your games. And if you don't win your games, this is what can happen. Again, if you're playing a dome team, I'd say it's even up at best for Kansas City in terms of their chances. Probably I'm leaning Miami. But they didn't draw a dome team. They're going to play outside in January in Kansas City, and it does not help their cause. Can they win it? Sure. Will they win it? I doubt it.
Next game, Houston hosting Cleveland. We kind of talked about this one in last week's episode in terms of nightmare playoff matchups, and I said that Cleveland did not want Houston to win the division. Well, Houston won the division. And they're going to have to go back to Houston, which they just beat Houston a few weeks ago. I think it was Christmas Eve when that game was. And they beat them soundly. But that was not the Texans. That was the Texans without CJ Stroud and without Will Anderson, potentially the offensive rookie and defensive rookie of the year. Will Anderson, one of the most effective pass rushers in the entire NFL. If we're just looking at pass rush win rate, you know, whether you double team him or not, doesn't really matter. Like, he's been incredible this year. CJ Stroud's been a top 6 to 7 quarterback in the NFL this year. Like, this is a dynamic, explosive offense with him under center, and a much more dynamic defense with Will Anderson out there too. It's not going to be an easy game for the Browns. It's not a good matchup for the Browns when those two are out there. I do take Houston for that reason.
I'm going to go with Cleveland in a squeaker on the road. You've always got to have some upsets. And with Schwartz and Cleveland's defensive roster, I think they are going to cause Stroud just enough problems. He has been outstanding. He's played lights out. He doesn't have all of his weapons. He's showed that he can play even without all of his weapons. I would not be surprised if he makes the plays to turn the game, but I think Flacco has one more magic trick up his sleeve. I know it's on the road. It is one of the more unlikely stories, but we love that Cleveland roster going into the year. They have, I don't want to say more of their guys. They have a lot of their guys. They too have suffered injuries, but I like the way their secondary matches up against the receivers that are left in Houston. It's going to be a close game either way. It's going to be one of the more exciting games of the weekend, but I'm going to take Cleveland in a field goal winner on the road.
I think the only team that's happy about this matchup, because obviously Houston would prefer not to have to deal with the Browns because they're sure. One of the three best teams in the AFC right now. But I think the only team that's happy about this matchup is the Ravens, because it's Houston and Cleveland knocking each other out. And so they're only going to have to deal with one of those. Like, I think Baltimore right now would rather play against Pittsburgh or Buffalo or Miami or Kansas City. They would not want to play against CJ Stroud. They would, because they already had to deal with him in week one, and they jumped on him early in the first half, and then CJ kind of got it in the second half and
scared
started
him.
Making a bunch of throws. And I think In the second half, Baltimore's like, uh-oh, he's giving an issue. And then they kind of built on that the rest of the year. I don't think they want to see CJ Stroud again, and I definitely don't think they want to see the Browns again. So one of these two teams is going to be doing Baltimore a favor. Moving on to the NFC. Green Bay, Dallas, narratives galore in this one. I think the NFC playoff slate is just messy drama, and I love it. And this game is a poster child of that. Who's your pick?
I think Dallas pulls this one off, and this is a hard thing for me to say, but Dallas has been a different team this season. Dallas is always the team that, even if they get to the postseason, you're like, yeah, but they're going to fold. I don't feel that way this year. They're the more veteran team. For sure, they, I think, prevail over the youngest team in the NFL. I don't think Green Bay is a bad team, and I do give them a puncher's chance, especially with, you know, as well as their quarterback's been playing, as deeply as it pains me to say that, he's been really, really good this year. Dak's been better. And just keep McCarthy away from the timeout button and the challenge flag and let Dak and the offense cook. I think Dallas can take this one. I think Green Bay is a year away. Again, would I be shocked if they pulled the upset here? No, but I think Dallas wins this one and moves on to the next round.
I speak for Packers fans, and it's rare that I do that. But I speak for Packers fans when I say that I still have so much lingering trauma from watching
you have
Mike
trauma.
McCarthy in the playoffs.
That's funny.
And it's funny because, like, I, you know, hey, I pray for the downfall every year, and we would get it every single year. But at the same time, watching the McCarthy-led Packers, and even to a degree watching the McCarthy-led Cowboys, there's still so many instances where I think, like, what the fuck is he doing? That, like, I even got a little bit traumatized by the decision making, where I'm like, this doesn't, like, it doesn't make sense. Like, your thought process doesn't make sense. And so if this is a one-score game, I think the Packers are more likely to win a one-score game than the Cowboys are. Because, yes, everything is telling me that Dallas has the more talented team and Dak is the better quarterback and the Cowboys have the better defense and, like, their assistants are great. Like, everything's good in Dallas. Like, it's a good team. They're a two seed for a reason. But if it's a one-score game, in the last 4 minutes of the first half and the last 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, I've just seen McCarthy fuck it up too many times for me to just suddenly think that he learned his lesson. And we literally just saw him get away with it against Detroit a few weeks ago. Like, he's still doing it. He's still making bad game management decisions. When we went to Dallas and watched the Patriots game in person, you know, at the end of the half sequence with the field goal, Like, we were even confused in the stadium. We're like, there's 8 seconds left. What are we doing here? Like, his brain breaks in the last four minutes. I don't get it. And until I see him coach clean playoff games without making those game management mistakes, I'm just going to assume he's going to do it. And in a one score game, that's going to cost them. So I'm picking the Packers. I'm not feeling great about it. Like, I would love the Packers to get crushed, okay? Like, this is maybe me, like, hedging my own internal bets. Like, yeah, bear down, obviously. I want them to get smacked. I just don't think they will. Like, I really do think the Packers are going to win because, and Packers fans can back me up on this, they know what Mike's going to do in the playoffs. They saw it for years. And deep down, I think Cowboys fans know it too.
Yeah, that's where it comes from. And, you know, this, it starts in this game and it carries right into the next game. We're going to talk about the Rams versus Detroit. I think this is the juiciest game of this round, like, without question. You've got the prodigal son, Matt Stafford, returning. There were Lions fans who became, you know, the Detroit Rams, right? They supported him. They wanted him to win that Super Bowl. Now he comes home and, like, he steps on the field and he's going to know. Like, he already knows it's them or me. Like, and Matt Stafford, above all things, great competitor, loved his time, but he's not going to roll over for the Lions. Like, don't have that in your mind. It's going to be epic either way. The atmosphere is going to be electric. First home playoff game in Detroit, long time. I think the Rams interior rush throws off Goff's timing just enough. And Stafford is, like I said, he's going to be slinging it. He's just going to be out for blood. And the Rams, I think, are going to continue their what I would term very unlikely role in this season. I think McVay goes one more round. I think the Rams win this one.
I would have taken the Lions if LaPorta was healthy. And we still don't know if he's going to play or not. But the fact that, like, the deciding factor for whether or not he's going to play is, like, how much Toradol can you fit in a human being's bloodstream? Like, that's when they say day to day, that's what they mean, right? Is like, he's going to be hurt. He's going to barely be able to move. And a healthy Sam LaPorta is a difference maker, like a huge difference maker. He's a massive component to their offense. An unhealthy Sam LaPorta, or even worst case scenario, no Sam LaPorta, fundamentally changes what Detroit is capable of, in my opinion. Yes, they still have a dynamic running back duo. You know, they still got Amon-Ra. Like, J-Mo could take the top off. Like, I get, like, I'm not saying he's the only piece that matters, but it does feel like, you know, every single third down, they're looking at Sam and saying, please go make a play. And he does, like, without fail. As a rookie, he does that. Like, that is how important he is that when they get into a jam, it's Sam LaPorta time. And they're going to be in a lot of jams in this game. And without him being healthy, I'm not sure if they're going to be able to get out of it with the same frequency, let alone the fact that, like, their secondary, again, how many years in a row we've been talking about this secondary just not being able to cover. They still can't do it. They're, like, bottom six in pass defense. You know, Aiden's is a great pass rusher for them, but, you know, nobody else has really consistently stepped up. So it's like a one-man show in the pass rush, and they can't cover. I don't know, man. I get really, really tough vibes about this game for Detroit specifically. And the Rams are such a hot team right now. Not saying that they don't have their own flaws. Like, the Rams corners aren't any better than Detroit's. Like, they can't cover either. It's like there will be points scored in this game for both teams, but ultimately, yes. I think the Rams are a little bit more complete than Detroit, sans Sam LaPorta. And ultimately, I agree with you. I think that the Rams are going to win.
I'm just going to throw a note on at the end for all the Detroit fans. I want the Lions to win. I really want, just if you're just asking me as a fan, like, what I want to happen, Detroit fans deserve it. Like, I want the Lions to win the game. I just think the Rams, you know, I'm not going to be, like, sad. I'm going to be thrilled if the Lions win the game because this has been a magical season for them, and I would love to see that continue for Lions fans. I just think the Rams are on a very particular roll right now that very few people saw coming.
All right, Philly, Tampa Bay. It's funny. We both thought, you know, this game was like upset alert when we recorded the episode last week of like, oh, the Bucks are the nightmare matchup for the Eagles. Like, watch out. Like, they could upset them. Like, I don't think it's really an upset. Like, I know Vegas says Philly's favored by 2.5. In what universe should the Eagles be favored over Tampa Bay at this point? Like, maybe if you think that Baker's rib/ankle injury, but if Baker is playing at like a reasonable Baker level, like what is giving people any confidence whatsoever that the Eagles are going to beat Tampa after getting the shit kicked out of them by the Giants the week after they lost to the Cardinals? Like, what am I missing here? How are the Eagles favored in this game? I don't understand it.
I don't think you're missing anything. I think Baker beats the slumping Eagles, who've been the gang that can't shoot straight since they went 10-1. First team ever in the NFL to go 10-1 and not win 12 games. Like, their slide, their collapse, whatever you want to call it, in the back half of the season has been epic, like historic in proportion. They lost in that stretch to the 49ers. Okay, I get it. Cowboys, also get it. Seahawks, that was kind of iffy. Then Cardinals, then Giants. Like, it's just picking up steam. It's like a rock rolling downhill. It's not where they want to be heading at the end of the season. Bucks, on the other hand, playing very solid football. I think they match up decently. Again, if you're talking about the first half of the season Eagles, this is Eagles in a walk. Like, it's not close. But this isn't the first half of the season Eagles. This is the reality of Philadelphia right now. And if you look at, you know, prominent Philadelphia fans around, they are not going into this game with any kind of confidence or bravado. They're talking zero shit. They're worried, and with good reason.
They're talking shit on their own team at this point.
Right.
Like, there's a lot of Eagles fans that are like, I don't even know why we're here, man. Like, can we just give our spot to the Saints? Like, what are we doing here? Like, the only team ever to start 10-1 and then not win 12 games. Like, that's...
It's unreal.
I've never seen anything like this Eagles team. Ever. And, oh, by the way, Nick Sirianni, I know he's not listening to this. How'd that Sean Desai firing go for you? Yeah? Working out okay? Cool. Just making sure.
I hate to bring it up, but it feels a little bit like the news we started off the podcast with the Vrabel firing. Like, oh, you took a thing that was, you know, maybe not working as well as you thought it could, but you thought better was out there. Like, that turned into a tire fire immediately, like week one, and it hasn't gotten better. Like we said, it's gotten progressively worse. So, this is not Sean Desai defense. Like, a lot of people would say Sean Desai can't coach defense if they're Philadelphia fans. I get it. It was not great, but it got like immediately worse and has progressively gone downhill. So, yeah, it's the frying pan to fire thing.
Well, here's my thing with Sean Desai. We've seen him be a very good football coach elsewhere before. Like, we know that man can coach. And I think... I look at that Eagles defense, I was like, he was just trying to keep it together because he knew that they were kind of fucked personnel-wise. Like, they don't have any corners that can cover. Their linebackers get shredded every week. Like, yeah, they had the defensive line, but like, Sean Desai was just trying to keep them afloat. And yeah, you can say that they were not staying all the way afloat, but now they're just sinking. Yeah. So, and you know, fast, he at least like kept them faster. Somewhat buoyant.
Yeah. And they have just, it's like cutting a line on a sinker. Like, it's just picking up speed.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think Bucks are going to win. Short of Baker really not looking right because of those injuries. And I do think that's probably why Vegas is favoring the Eagles, because they think that Baker's significantly hurt. But if he just plays average... This Eagles defense is so bad that they make average offenses look pretty darn good. So, yeah, those are our picks. Again, just to recap, Tampa, we agreed on Tampa. We agreed on the Rams. We disagreed on Green Bay and Dallas. I've got the Packers. EJ has the Cowboys. We disagreed on Browns-Texans. EJ's got the Browns. I've got the Texans because I'm loyal. Damn it. Always will be.
I don't get to be loyal to a team in the playoffs because my team doesn't get to the playoffs.
One day, Caleb will lead you to the promised land. We'll see. Miami KC. We agree on KC winning this one in frigid conditions, and then we agree on Buffalo ending an improbable 10-win run for Pittsburgh this year. I want to thank all of our executive producers for making this episode possible. Eichen, Marat, Consti, Andrew, Liam, Connor, and Mike L. Also want to assure you guys that our Ring of Honor Q&A will be happening soon. We're just trying to figure out the exact date for that because we're trying to sort out travel for Shrine Bowl and Combine and our playoff schedule and everything like that. There's a lot of bullets flying this time of year, so we're trying to figure that out. And we'll probably be contacting you guys individually to get your own schedules too, because we want you guys to be able to go to that. If you guys want to join the Ring of Honor yourself, or really any of our Patreon tiers, that of course is linked down in the description below to directly support the show, and we appreciate if you do that. Also, if you don't want to support us on Patreon, but you still want to indirectly/directly support the show, bootleg gear is available over on Homage. We get a cut of everything that you buy on Homage, even if it's not bootleg gear and it's something to support your actual NFL fandom, because they have the NFL license. Anything you get from Homage, we get a cut of that. So thank you if you guys shop there as well. And with that, EJ, let's get out of here. We have mock draft season to prepare for. We have a lot of prospects to watch before
all that
go
other
Shrine
stuff
Bowl.
To do.
Yeah. This is the busy time of year where we have to do playoff talk and draft talk at the exact same time. I don't know about you, but I am incredibly far behind on Shrine Bowl guys and Senior Bowl guys. So that's
it. Feels like the middle of the summer where sort of all three lines of work came together in the middle of the preview series, and we went, "Oh no!" Like this is that month. January is like, "Oh, we got to finish out the best football of the year in the NFL strong. We got to do a Super Bowl preview." Oh yeah, and by we actually have to record the Super Bowl preview at the All-Star game. Oh yeah, right. It's that time of year again.
But, you know, I guess we can't complain too much. We watch football for a living, even if we're not very good at it. But we do get to do it as our job. So thank you once again to everybody for watching and listening, however you happen to be consuming the show. Not entirely sure what our schedule is going to be for next week, because, again, all of the moving parts that we just talked about. But make sure to follow us on Twitter. We'll let you know when and what we're doing. And with that, we will see you soon-ish.
Take care.